Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. One word. That's the difference between what the Massachusetts House and the Senate want to see passed on abortion. And that word? Severe. Clock's ticking. Legislative session ends in just 12 days. Now, we're reckoning with a post-Roe world at the state and the federal level. And in fact, joining us now on the line, Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan, who has just stepped out of a hearing on the reversal of Roe v. Wade in D.C. Congresswoman Trahan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you for having me. Good morning, Tiziana.
Good morning. You've called the Roe reversal the defining issue of our lifetime. So much has happened just in the last few years, Congresswoman. Why this one?
Well, I think when the Supreme Court officially overturned abortion protections guaranteed by Roe v. Wade just over 3 weeks ago, so many of us called that decision disastrous. But in the time since then, it's proven to be exactly that for thousands of women in Republican-controlled states who saw their rights that they and their mothers have cherished for the past 50 years stripped away. And while we're fortunate to call Massachusetts home, a state that has always and will always stand up for a woman's right to abortion care, we've seen a number of reports in recent days that prove we can't just be content with that. Extreme anti-abortion groups are encouraging Republican lawmakers to stop talking about abortion as a state's rights issue and start plotting a national ban. And Republicans are taking their marching orders. So while we have the Roe Act and other key protections here in the Commonwealth, anti-choice Republicans are targeting states like ours next.
So what is more disastrous than you would have anticipated in the last few weeks? We knew this verdict was coming down, at least in theory, for a while. There's been much public discussion for several years now, especially as new justices were being appointed to the Supreme Court, of what could come our way. What has caught you by surprise?
Well, I think the decision is written by Clarence Thomas, right? I mean, we know, and on Thursday, we're going to take action to establish a constitutional right to birth control, something that none of us ever imagined we'd have to fight for in 2022.
So just to clarify for listeners, you're talking about his concurring opinion where he raised the question of whether some other key cases, including ones that protected the right to contraception, marriage equality, potentially even interracial marriage, might need to be reconsidered. Sorry for interrupting.
Absolutely. And look, later this week, we'll pass legislation that would enshrine the Marriage Equality Act for same-sex and interracial couples. So we're not just going to stand by while an extremist minority tries to undo decades of progress and take away the rights of millions of Americans. And that's why the House of Representatives took up and passed the Women's Health Protection Act last week, legislation that would guarantee the right of every woman in America to access the reproductive care they need. But there's many other issues caught in the crosshairs post-Roe, and we're taking action on that as well.
Congresswoman Lori Trahan with us from Washington. Will that pass? Will any of that pass in the House and the Senate?
Well, right now, I think all eyes are on the Senate. Certainly, you know, we were able to pass the Women's Protection Health Act out of the House, and all eyes are on the Senate. I mean, look, this is the defining issue of our lifetime, of our generation, and I think it's one that we're all in together. I don't think that this is going to be a fight that we win overnight. I think people are understanding right now that elections matter. We need to win in Ohio and Pennsylvania, those Senate races. We need to return Maggie Hassan so that we do have a pro-choice majority in our Senate and in our House of Representatives.
So you raise an interesting and tense point. There are predictions that it's possible that Democrats could lose the House and the Senate in November. And of course, Roe v. Wade has already been overturned. Other states are already taking action. My question to you is there something that could be passed in this House and Senate before the midterm elections in November, before Democrats, you being a Democrat, run the risk of losing their majority, that would be acceptable to you?
Look, I think right now everything is on the table in terms of what we can do to protect the rights that we've had as women in this country for over 50 years. And certainly, thinking on a longer term horizon, what we need to do to secure those majorities, to make sure that we are holding a Supreme Court that has frankly lost its legitimacy, accountable for these decisions which fly in the face of popular opinion, that fly in the face of what we've come to cherish in terms of rights for women, for same-sex marriage, for access to contraception and in vitro fertilization. So I think in the very, very short term, our heads are down to figure out what we just passed in the House, what we can pass in the Senate before this election, and then also rallying that public support around the country so that we build up our majorities that are for protecting these rights, for expanding our progress as a country, not for taking rights away.
And I'm sorry to stay on this a little bit longer, but is there something that you think could get passed in the Senate?
I do. Look, I'm always optimistic that there will be, an opportunity for people to, for the Senate to hear the cries of the American people. I think with every story right now that we're hearing and the hearing that I just stepped out of, around the horror that is happening across our country, in Ohio, a 10-year-old girl, not much older than my youngest daughter, became pregnant after she was raped, denied abortion care in her home state, forced to travel to Indiana to terminate a pregnancy that she had no say in and no control over. In Louisiana, a woman who had just miscarried was forced through a painful hours-long labor to deliver a non-viable fetus. She didn't want that, but the hospital lawyer said she had no choice. As these stories come to life, we have to use that as momentum to fix what the Supreme Court just rolled back on women across the country.
I'm going
to
play a little sound for you here, Congresswoman Lori Trahan. Representative Ayanna Pressley was with us. We did a special show the day the decision from the Supreme Court was released, and she talked about what she wanted to see done moving forward. Here she is.
We have to employ every tool available to us at every level of government until we enshrine and codify abortion care, health care as a constitutional right, as it has been for the last 50 years before this Supreme Court obstructed the will of majority of Americans and overturned it.
We have more women in our congressional delegation and in the Senate here in Massachusetts than ever before. Are you all in lockstep on this? Does Congresswoman Pressley represent your thoughts and feelings there too?
Absolutely. Look, I think when she says every level of government, it is really important that people understand who they're electing. I mean, Ayanna and I, Congresswoman Pressley and I, we came in together in 2018 in a wave of electing more women who would set the priorities of what Congress and Washington was going to focus on and preserving our rights as women so that we're not rolling back and being treated as second-class citizens is important to make every candidate who is running for every position. You make them make it discussable. I mean, look, there were a lot of us who said after the draft opinion became public a couple of months ago that no option should be taken off the table as we work to reverse this disastrous decision. In my opinion, that applies to parliamentary procedure in Congress, like getting rid of the filibuster, and that applies to checking the balance of a Supreme Court that's become little more than a political weapon for right-wing extremists. I mean, we voted in the House to codify women's right to abortion care, and we've done it three times. I support eliminating the arcane and useless filibuster to pass that legislation in the Senate. And we should vote to rein in the power of the Supreme Court so no more nominees feel like they can sit before the Senate, lie through their teeth under oath, and then get confirmed to a lifetime appointment on the bench.
So you're saying that you feel that Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett lied during their hearings?
Yes. Shame on the senators who were snowed by them. I mean, I think that there are a number of ways to hold the Supreme Court bench accountable. It's my hope that we're able to take up a proposal or a suite of bills to hold those justices accountable to what they say under oath.
So I want to bring it back home here to Massachusetts for a little bit for you. There's a debate here. So you're in the 3rd District, which represents, for example, Lawrence Chelmsford, Lancaster. You know we're having this discussion at the state level as well. Massachusetts has strong abortion rights codified into law already, but the legislature in the remaining days of this session seeking to do more. And the sticky wicket between the House and the Senate is this idea of severe. So the bill, the new bill that the House has under design, would allow abortions after 24 weeks in cases of severe fetal anomalies, which is different than now, where it's fatal fetal anomalies. The Senate has balked at that, saying that there could be, for example, as argued by disability rights advocates, moves to abort fetuses who are viable but have severe disabilities. Where do you come out on that, and where do you want to see our legislature come out?
So first of all, let's just start with how fortunate we are to have leaders here in Massachusetts who recognize the need to strengthen abortion protections following the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe. There are millions of women in Republican-controlled states who are watching as their leaders are doing the exact opposite, actually stripping away the rights they've cherished for the past 50 years and looking to go even further than the bans that they already have in place. I think the legislative package put forth by the legislature, in combination, you know, with the governor's executive action right after the decision, is critical in protecting women's right to abortion care and shielding care providers from being penalized by draconian laws from other states. Now, I know that they're working through a few minor differences right now, and I fully expect them to reach an agreement on that legislation, just as they did when they passed the Roe Act, which has been critical already in protecting our reproductive care. So, look, we have a pro-choice legislature and the most pro-choice legislature in the Commonwealth's history, and that shouldn't get lost in the conversation over a single word in a legislative proposal that will enshrine stronger abortion rights than pretty much any other state in our country.
In our remaining time, I'd like to shift gears. We originally were talking with you about appearing last week on the show, and then you very publicly announced that you had COVID. First, I want to ask you, how are you? How are you feeling?
Oh, thank you for that. I feel much better. I really do. I'm back in Washington, and I'm happy to be here.
So I know that your daughter also tested positive, and I have to tell you that struck a chord with me because my daughter and I did at the holidays and wound up isolating together, which was a combination of miserable and wonderful. So how was isolation for you?
Well, it was busy. She had a very different idea of what isolating was going to be like than I did. But in between hearings and committee meetings, I did get to play pie in the face, which, if you don't know, it's when you get whipped cream in your face. And she was elated that we were able to quarantine, you know, together. But yes, it had its ups and downs for sure.
I am so glad my daughter did not know about pie in the face when we were isolating together. All right. Before I let you go, one other thing. I know you're well aware that on Thursday night there will be another primetime hearing on the January 6th insurrection. What are you watching for and hoping to see out of that hearing on Thursday night?
Well, look, I fully expect that Thursday's hearing to follow along the lines of the prior hearings, right? This is the committee has been conducting a serious bipartisan investigation focused on finding the facts. And from the first couple of hearings alone, it's obvious that there was far more to Donald Trump's plot to overturn the 2020 election than any of us knew. Detailing, you know, the assault on the U.S. Capitol, the violence inflicted on police officers simply trying to do their jobs, and the goal of these dangerous extremists who took their orders from the previous president. I think the committee's done a good job taking politics out of the equation with these hearings. And while I don't have any special insight into what we're going to see, I fully expect it to be another gripping display of the facts they've uncovered. And I'll just say, as someone who was watching, waiting, and wondering why the National Guard wasn't deployed immediately, I look forward to getting to those answers about what exactly was happening in the Oval Office during those critical hours. So I know I'll be watching, and I expect that millions of Americans will be as well, just as they have been for the previous hearings.
So it's a little personal for you, too.
Absolutely.
So last question, are your constituents watching? Have you heard from the people you represent that they care about and are paying attention to these hearings?
Yeah, look, when I go home and when I'm, you know, in my district talking to folks, right there, first and foremost, I mean, there is hardship in families who are just struggling to make ends meet. But I do think that in the background of all of that is this, you know, the Supreme Court reversal of Roe v. Wade that has really traumatized so many families because it's a rollback of rights, and also the threat to our democracy that we need to shore up, we need to prevent that happens again. I mean, I hear about all of that when I'm home, and I do think people are watching the hearings. They want to understand what exactly happened that day. They want to make sure that we get history right so that it's never repeated again. But certainly, you know, when I'm home, and the thing that I'm most focused on right now is how do we alleviate, you know, the rising costs for folks back home, and how do we keep money in families' pockets at a time when they need it the most?
All right. That is Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan, who represents the 3rd District, which includes Lawrence, Chelmsford, and Lancaster. Congresswoman, you stepped out of a hearing in D.C. to join us this morning. I appreciate you doing that. Thanks for your time.
Oh, you bet. Thanks so much.
Right now, after a jump in monkeypox cases, 11 state health clinics are set to give out the monkeypox vaccine, and they're now bracing for an influx of appointments.
That NBC 10 report is from yesterday. There are more than 50 cases in Massachusetts at last count after the first case in the U.S. was reported here in May. But Provincetown is on it, drawing lessons from the HIV/AIDS pandemic, lessons we can use. To tell us how they're doing it, with us, State Senator Julian Cyr, who represents Provincetown, and Dan Gates, president and CEO of the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod. State Senator Cyr, welcome.
Good morning, Tiziana.
And Dan Gates, welcome to you as well.
Good morning, Tiziana.
So, State Senator Cyr, what is the latest on the virus in Provincetown? We know there's been at least one case, correct?
So MPV, or monkeypox, but we're referring to it as MPV, has been present in gay and bisexual men and men of sex with men for at least 6 weeks here in the United States. Actually, Massachusetts was the state that had the first confirmed case. So Provincetown, like any community with a large population of gay and bisexual men and men of sex with men, MPV is present here. And so we've been acting accordingly, first preparing with the tremendous partners that we have in our municipal health department, the county health department, Outer Cape Health Services, which is our remarkable community health center, community organizations like the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod, and we've got my friend Dan Gates on the line, and our local business community, in anticipating the presence of MPV in the context of the busy summer season. That first took the form of public education and awareness, especially to our seasonal and year-round residents and to our workforce. And really since the beginning of July, that's taken the form of a pretty robust vaccination effort that's provided vaccination to over 1,400, first dose vaccination to over 1,400 individuals.
So Dan Gates of the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod, what did that early public education look like? What were the messages?
Sure. So the early messaging was, and a lot of our initial outreach was via social media and contacting people directly. But the early messaging was just to remember that while this is not an STI, it's a contagious viral disease that was
sexually transmitted infection is STI, correct? Sorry to interrupt you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. No, you're right. Acronyms. So it was really about reaching the community most impacted. Our community was at risk, obviously. So the messaging was just on the facts that we knew at the time and on ways to prevent and identify.
And what's working, Dan Gates?
Community. I would say the community response has been phenomenal. We are very fortunate to have friends like Senator Cyr and Representative Peek. Really, they were Senator Cyr and Representative Peek were on this right from the start. So what's been working is reaching out to people and finding ambassadors within the community. The way to do this is to have people talk to other people, and that way you can get into some of the nuance of the conversation more. So we've been really fortunate to have friends at local bars who are, you know, bartenders or service staff or performers in town, all really gather, get information, and share that within their own social networks.
So, Senator Julian Cyr, it's hard to imagine something that's more both global and local than when you've got a virus spreading both globally and locally. What is it about the Provincetown community that allowed everyone to mobilize so quickly? And what was most important for you to do in your role as the state senator?
Well, here in Provincetown, this certainly isn't our first infectious disease. And actually, in the context of COVID-19, this isn't our first pandemic. Provincetown in the 80s and early 90s and really ever since has been on the forefront in responding to the HIV/AIDS, pandemic at a time when governments at all levels were turning their back on gay and bisexual men who were living with AIDS and who were dying of AIDS. Provincetown was, really mounted a community-based response, starting actually with the AIDS support group, starting with a number of other, members in our community, really at a time, right, where LGBTQ people were, seen as pariahs and not supported, and not seen as worthy or deserving of attention and care. And so, here at Lens End, we had to create our own response, and really in Provincetown, we pioneered some of the most effective responses to HIV/AIDS until the HIV cocktails came along in the mid-90s. And that legacy is something that continues here. That's something that I certainly grew up with. A lot of my own motivation and interest in public health and public service comes out of the response to the HIV/AIDS pandemic here. And it's also given us lessons and tools that we can rely on as a community. I hearken back to last summer, when we were dealing with really the first documented outbreak of the Delta variant of COVID-19, which was here in Provincetown. And really what we saw in the Delta outbreak last year was that it was the health-seeking behavior of our community, right?
Behavior? And tell us what you mean by that.
Well, health-seeking behavior, right, means, if I'm feeling sick, if I got a sore throat or I got something going on that's not... that I'm not feeling well, that I'm going to go seek medical attention. And Americans are not very good at seeking medical attention. And men are particularly bad at seeking medical attention, right? There's all this data about how, men in America sort of end up very, very sick in the emergency department because they're not receiving care. The difference with gay and bisexual men, and I'm part of, I'm a queer man. We have been taught, from an early age that you do seek medical attention, that you do seek health care, which is part of the legacy of HIV/AIDS. So when it came to Delta last summer, people like me, my friends, right, our cohort, people were getting sick in early July. And instead of just sort of blowing off the symptoms, they went to our community health center, maybe thinking they had strep throat, maybe they had a sexually transmitted infection. And it turns out that it was COVID. We were able to document this, respond really, really swiftly. And the Provincetown Delta cluster first and foremost informed federal, national policy around COVID-19, and that with the Delta variant, that it was possible for vaccinated individuals to contract COVID. And then also, we were able to really stem the outbreak and really didn't have the reach it could have had because of that health-seeking behavior.
So State Senator Julian Cyr, they're telling us about how the experiences from last summer's Delta outbreak in Provincetown reflect this summer's ahead-of-the-curve action by Provincetown on monkeypox, or MPV. Also with us, Dan Gates, who's president and CEO of the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod. Dan, I'm going to play a little sound for you. This is courtesy of ABC News. It's Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's the chief medical advisor to the White House last Friday.
It's something we need to take seriously, not to panic by it, because we do have a lot of understanding of it, as well as countermeasures. There are vaccines that are available to prevent and respond to monkeypox. There are antivirals that are available. So we're not in the dark about this, although we really must take it seriously.
So, Dan, how is the vaccine campaign going? Senator Cyr made reference to it earlier in the conversation.
Yeah, I would say it's going phenomenally well. The one thing that I think really helps Provincetown in a moment like this is the key with a public health response is the communal response. It's not about an individual. It's about taking care of one another. the way people have jumped on. I mean, we learned we would have access to vaccines here in Provincetown for MPV on July 6th. Outer Cape Health Services was administering the vaccine the next day, so July 7th. And as Senator Sear mentioned, we've had over 1,400 people get vaccinated in Provincetown already. And much like the parallels with COVID, we have an extremely high vaccination rate here in P-Town for COVID. This community really does seem to understand, I think it is the legacy of HIV and AIDS in town, that public health is all about a community response and that we're in this together.
And Dan, just briefly remind us who qualifies for a vaccine for MPV right now in the Commonwealth.
Sure. So right now, anyone who is considered to be at high risk of being exposed to monkeypox, as well as those who have known they have been exposed to monkeypox. So a high risk group, and particularly right now, is for gay, bi, trans, and non-binary folks who identify as male.
And Senator Sear, that 24-hour turnaround between news of the vaccine and getting it, that was your experience, yes?
Yes, it was. I was. I have received the first dose JYNNEOS vaccine for MPV. I qualify. I'm a man who has sex with men, and we really focused on reaching out to our seasonal workforce and to, you know, the people who live here year round, the folks that we call townies, first, because we wanted to make sure that they have some degree of protection. But the fabulous thing about this vaccine is we know that with one, it's a two-dose regime, but with the first dose, within 2 weeks, you have 85% protection against MPV, which is pretty high for a vaccine. And so what we did is we made sure that the bartenders, the waiters, the folks who are cleaning rooms, you know, the people who, you know, make a life here on Land's End, that they got a first chance to get this vaccination. Because, you know, yes, monkeypox, if you contract MPV, certainly it's painful, it's uncomfortable, there's a level of, you know, shame and challenge associated with it, but it also can be financially devastating to someone's livelihood. MPV, essentially, you have to be fully recovered, you have to wait till the pustules burst, scab over, and new skin grows. That's a 2 to 3 week process. It could even be longer. If you're a bartender, if you're a waiter, if you're someone working in our hospitality sector here, we've got a short 10-week season. Being out of work for 2 or 3 weeks, that's 20-30% of your income. That could be devastating to your livelihood. So we really focus on making sure that we took care of our hospitality workers, our restaurant, our workers, the folks who are serving people every day here, to make sure that we not only protect them from MPV, but we're making sure that they have some level of protection for their livelihoods as well.
We're talking with State Senator Julian Sear and Dan Gates of the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod about monkeypox or MPV. And I want to take that part head on, Dan. You are pushing for us to use the medical term MPV instead of monkeypox because of stigma around monkeypox. Can you explain that to us a bit?
Sure. I think monkeypox, I think what was helpful about that phrase is it definitely is something that once people hear it, it resonates and they remember it. What's not helpful sometimes is kind of the associations that can come with that, where it can be very misleading as to what the risks are, right? So it is, again, it's people who are sexually active who are at risk. And by just focusing on the MPV, it's actually not dissimilar to educating people early on about the difference between HIV and AIDS, right? Language really matters. It's important to our legacy here in Provincetown at the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod is providing services for people that are free of stigma. And so we're very intentional about our language so that we can be inclusive.
So one of the things you'd like our listeners to do is consider using MPV instead of monkeypox in everyday language as we continue as a Massachusetts community to discuss this viral spread.
Absolutely.
All right. So Senator Sear, I'm going to come back to you for a minute as well. The other thing early on in the public conversation with this round this year of MPV or monkeypox were misperceptions that it was actually a sexually transmitted infection, as opposed to something that's transmitted by close contact, which means if you have sexual contact, that's pretty close contact. Talk about how important that is, both to the LGBTQ community for us to understand more broadly, and in our shifting response to the spread of this virus.
Well, you know, I think giving people information about what a given virus is, how it's transmitted, and what are steps that people can take to reduce their risk of transmission is really important. And so, you know, MPV is transmitted by close intimate contact. Close intimate contact happens when you're having sex, but it's just not, close intimate contact is not only just confined to when folks have sex. So we've been really talking about this in our community to make sure that, you know, particularly before we had, you know, the level of vaccination, we weren't sure if we were going to get, you know, arguably such a substantial supply of vaccine. And a real credit to, you know, the Executive Office of Health and Human Services and the Department of Public Health and the Baker Administration in getting a very kind of significant supply of vaccine early on. That was hard to do. But for those who have not yet been able to get vaccinated, and even if you are vaccinated, right, you need to understand how this is potentially transmitted, and then you can take steps to, you know, reduce your risk. Even having conversations, you know, with people that you're having close intimate contact with. Hey, you know, how are you feeling? Do you have any, you know, let's turn the lights on and take a look at one another and see if we have any signs of, I don't know, if there's, you know, just take a look. Those sort of steps help reduce the risk of further transmission of MPV. And so that's why talking about it is really important. That's why, you know, people like me, right, who are out people who are kind of public, it's important for people like me to be talking about MPV, but the steps people can take to reduce the risk, encouraging people to get vaccinated when vaccination's available, so we can get ahead of this.
And Dan, just briefly as we wrap, you said earlier memories of disease responses in the sidewalk and the sand here. Is Provincetown a lesson in what to do right that we could turn to now and again in the future when it comes to virus transmission?
Absolutely. As it was in the 80s and 90s, it has been for the last few years. It's all about that community response, coming together, honest, like what Senator Steer was just saying, right? Using your own story as you talk to people and using the vulnerable parts of yourself. And then there's a communal response that starts at a grassroots level. And that is always the most effective way to move forward. We're really lucky we have a template here in Provincetown and a wonderful, wonderfully engaged community.
All right. Dan Gates is president and CEO of the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod, and State Senator Julian Sear, whose district includes Provincetown. Thanks to both of you for joining us today to teach us these lessons.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Lace. It was so valuable in the late 1700s that you could use it like money. Now imagine 600 women, men, children in Ipswich making it at home. They became an economic engine, but are now mostly a part of Massachusetts' hidden history. Joining us now, two people working to bring lace making back to life. Catherine Chasen is the curator at the Ipswich Museum, and Mary Mangin makes lace and is a member of the New England Lace Group. Catherine and Mary, welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Great to have you here in studio, too. I'm going to start right off with a little bit of sound for us. This is the sound of bobbin lace being made.
Okay, now I'm over to this side, so I'm going to do the full stitch with a twist. Whoa, I pulled too aggressively.
So Catherine of the Ipswich Museum, I watched this video earlier and it's incredible because, okay, try to picture this. It's like if you see somebody shuffling through a box of sticks, like it looks like they're looking for something, right? I'm moving this one, I'm shuffling stuff all around. But instead of it being random, lace is actually coming out of the other end of the sticks. It's
yes,
crazy.
It really is.
It's really complex.
It's
tell
very
us.
Complex. With the day I started working at the Ipswich Museum, they tried to teach me, and I made them not, basically. But these ladies who do it, Mary is one of them, they're able to take these combinations of the wooden bobbins and make these beautiful creations that you see in front of you in the studio out of this complicated process. It's like a card dealer who's able to just do it without thinking.
It does kind of look like shuffling cards, Mary.
It does, but it's really actually only two basic movements. There's a cross and a twist, like knit and purl a little bit, in, if you're familiar with knitting at all. But it's the combination of those that creates the lovely patterns that we get as we make a larger piece of lace.
How long did it take you to learn, to get good at it?
Oh, to get good at it. Well, I'm not even good at it yet. I started in 2019. I took the basic introductory workshop. So this is luckily before the pandemic, because it was a great pandemic hobby. But I learned to make Ipswich lace during the pandemic. Lace makers have now adapted to Zoom, and so we're taking a lot of classes on Zoom now.
And so you brought us a sample, or
That's
a
right.
couple samples. So is this your lace?
This is all of my lace, yes.
So it's this beautiful black
silk.
Can you call it fabric? Do you call lace fabric?
It's a textile.
Okay, so beautiful black textile. It's silk, and it's got like a little diamond pattern in it and a weave with a with an edging. And is this representative, Catherine, of what would have been Ipswich lace?
Yes. Mary made this from a pattern that was created from samples of Ipswich lace that are found in Alexander Hamilton's papers at the Library of Congress.
So I want to pick up on that a little bit because, of course, I'm sure people are saying, I'm sorry, where did Alexander Hamilton come into this? So Karen Thompson, who works with New England Lace Group and was the first person to really dig deep into the history of Ipswich lace, found samples of the lace in Alexander Hamilton's papers, recreating and was working on recreating those patterns. We spoke with her about those papers and the significance of them. Let's hear a little bit of that.
So very rarely do we have a collection of lace, and I've studied many collections of lace, that we know exactly when and where they were made. We have some from war laces in Belgium during World War I, but from the early laces, it's very rare to have that much information. With these 22 samples at the Library of Congress, among Alexander Hamilton's papers, you know, we know exactly when and where they were made.
Why does Alexander Hamilton have 22 samples of Ipswich lace in his papers?
Well, Alexander Hamilton, when he was the Treasury Secretary, was very interested in the fledgling industries in America, and as such asked his contacts throughout America to collect data. And one of those industries happened to be the Ipswich cottage lace industry. So George Cabot talked to Reverend Joseph Dana of Ipswich, and he spent a year going from household to household, looking at what lace was being made, talking to the people who were making it, and collecting the statistics on it, along with the samples that were sent to Alexander Hamilton.
So cottage, when you say that, you really mean home-based, Catherine.
Correct.
Not tiny, because this was a significant piece of industry for Ipswich in the late 1700s.
If there were 601 households in Ipswich, there were over 600 lace makers in Ipswich. So that means that probably every single household was participating in this industry in some way, shape, or form.
So you're with the Ipswich Museum. You're the curator there. Why? What do we know about why so many people in one community in Massachusetts were making this thing that was valuable at the time called lace?
The why is a little bit of a mystery. We're not really sure who or what caused Ipswich to start making lace. Probably someone brought a pillow over from England and eventually taught everyone. But we do know why, and it's because you can trade lace for goods that were needed. They say that 1 yard of lace could be equivalent to a quart of wood or 16 pounds of sheep's wool. And so to produce this lace really gave Ipswich residents some economic certainty and freedom that they wouldn't have had otherwise.
So Mary Mangin, you're a lace maker. You've picked up these traditions from Ipswich using patterns drawn from Alexander Hamilton samples. I guess I'm assuming that at the time, so we have this thing, this silk woven or sewn into a textile that becomes as valuable as a currency. I guess I'm assuming that, like gold might be more valuable than silver, there might be different kinds of laces that were more or less valuable. Am I making that up in my head, or is that true?
Oh, certainly there are different groups around the world who made lace. The European laces were very highly favored, and they were very fine and refined. The American laces, although they were some of them look very similar to some of the European laces, it's not quite the same technique. And during the American Revolutionary War, though, you have to imagine that the importation of lace became problematic for a number of reasons. And so this would give a boost to the local lace makers who might be interested in creating this.
So, Mary, no offense to lace, but you can't cook with it. You can't use it as your whole garment. It doesn't, you know, clean with it or some of the other things you might do with a textile. Why was it so valuable?
Well, some of these women were able to pay tuition for their children at one of the local schools with the lace, and as well as trade it. We have ledgers of merchant ledgers that show that some of the women were trading for other goods from that as well.
So, Catherine, was it a symbol of status to have lace? Is that why it was
yes.
so valuable?
So lace was a way to show your wealth, basically. And you could kind of evaluate one's costume by the type of lace that they were wearing. And so wearing lace was a status symbol.
Is that why we see so much of it in paintings and portraits of people at that time?
Correct. You see it sewn onto collars and cuffs that were removable so that they could move them from outfit to outfit as need be. Lace was willed down in to daughters, to sons, things like that. Both men and women wore lace as well.
So I'm sorry. So it was basically bling.
Yes.
All right. So we have
bling.
We have the bling of the 1700s. Yes. It's being made in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Mary, why did it become important to you to be one of the people in our community who carries this art form forward?
I came to lace because I was working as a docent at one of the local Revolutionary War sites in the city of Somerville. I work at the old powder house, and I became interested in the clothing of the period, and that's when I was led to some of the interesting clothing details, and one of them was lace, and I began to understand the importance of lace in the significance of wealth in this time period, and the fact that women who were not wealthy women were making this for the wealthy women. So there's an interesting dynamic there as well. So I was interested in maintaining this craft and helping to promote it and raise the profile of these women who did all this work all those years ago.
Yeah, Catherine Chasen, who's the curator at the Ipswich Museum, I mean, that is hanging out there, right? We're talking about an industry that kept 600 people working, that made Ipswich a bit of a lace powerhouse, but we also know that so much of what we thought we knew about economies at that time are roiled in enslaved labor and discriminatory economies. So who made the lace in the late 1700s?
So pretty much in Ipswich, if you were a female or not able-bodied man or woman, you could be making lace. So that means you're elderly. Be it a male or a female, could make lace. A small boy could be making lace, but it was being made mainly by women. But, you know, I do want to add in the fact that while it was predominantly women, the younger men and the more elderly gentlemen were participating as well. So if you weren't able-bodied, it was a way that you could bring in income to your household that other communities didn't have that option.
And do we have eyes into any relationship between enslavement and lace making?
So unfortunately, our record books don't detail that the lace that was being traded into account books necessarily were made by slaves. But we do know that Ipswich residents owned slaves, and it's very conceivable that they were also involved in the lace making industry. Unfortunately, textiles tend to be not an attributed product. So like many women's labors, they go unsigned. And so we can't tell you necessarily who made which piece of lace. And that leaves a lot of questions out there.
Mary, I'll come back to you. Why is it important to preserve? I mean, there are patterns. I'm looking at, you have an actual pattern on the table here. It looks quite large. I was looking at it. It's diamond sort of in a zigzag. And then all of a sudden I realized, oh, wait, that's an enlarged version of the tiny little diamonds I saw on the piece of lace that you handed me at the beginning of our conversation. Why is it so important to bring these patterns, this skill, this tradition forward today? We don't use a lot of lace today.
Right. Well, we want to celebrate the work of these women and their artistry. And we also want to remember that this kind of work went on. But there's also a lot of information to be gleaned from the material culture of the time. And I think that people, when they see us making lace, they start to think more about how that was done, who did that. And it also points us to possible new resources that we might find around New England. We hope that there's people who around New England who will remember that this lace existed and find it in their archives.
Well, one of the things that you did was teach us that there is a community in New England called Lace Talk. That's a community of lace makers on TikTok. We pulled a little bit of that content to hear.
So do you want to know how this mess of thread becomes this lace brooch?
I just completed my very first bobbin lace project.
I have been working on lace making for a while now, and I just want to make something I can actually wear.
How much lace do I have, you ask?
Well, you see, my friend, your question is poorly worded.
I am Mr. Spitz, a lace maker.
3.6 million views under the hashtag lacemaking. As a lacemaker, what does it mean for you to see? I mean, I think it's fair to say, but looks like the beginning of an actual movement on social media among young people to take up this hundreds of years old craft.
There's a great energy around lace making right now. And I was mentioning to Catherine in the other room, too, that there's also some designers who are starting to use handmade lace and specializing in providing information about these lace makers who make these crafts in Italy. And so I hope that there's a revival of lace around the world and young people are interested in making it. It's really engaging. It's mentally engaging because you have to think through these patterns very carefully. But it's also just really lovely when you get a piece at the end.
So, Catherine, there are two questions sort of lurking in the back of my head. First, you pointed out most of the lace makers were women, children, and the phrase was able-bodied. No, the opposite.
Yes.
Men. That is partly because we were in a context of war.
We were in a context of war, but also we lived at a time where a lot of physical labor was required to produce everything that we needed on a day-to-day basis, from farming to creating the wood that we needed to fuel things, just a lot of physical labor. We created everything we consumed.
Chris, what's in the back of my mind is that the women were doing all of that, right? Making the bread, cooking the food all day, tending to the animals, but also making this lace.
Correct. They were squeezing it in their spare time.
All right. Remarkable. And the other thing that comes to mind is sooner or later, at some point, lace stopped being
Correct.
So valuable. Why?
Part of it was changing fashion. So as lace started to fall out of fashionable periods, it was not as required or valuable, but also was the advent of Industrial Revolution. Eventually, lace started to be made on machines. So this ground that you see, this netting, the basic netting, could be produced on a machine. And then only a few women were required to kind of embroider the same design.
To put the fancy patterns mm-hmm. over the basic.
Yes.
Pattern.
So the lace industry in Ipswich really kind of fell in the 1820s when this machine-made net appeared on the market and started to lower the prices, and it was no longer economically viable for them to continue to make it.
So very briefly, what then happened to Ipswich?
Well, Ipswich was bypassed as a port town, and we lost the lace industry, so it became kind of a sleepy little town. We eventually did get some industries back. The upside to that is today we have this wonderful preserved tradition that might not have survived if Ipswich had continued to become a more vibrant town.
All right. Catherine Chasen is the curator at the Ipswich Museum, and Mary Mangin is a lace maker and member of the New England Lace Group. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And listen, the idea for this segment of Hidden History came from our texting group. Do you have a piece of Massachusetts history that you think we should know about? Do you just want to be in dialogue with us here at Radio Boston? If so, we'd like you to join our texting group. And to do that, you get started by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382. I'll say that for you again. Text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us. Have a wonderful day. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.